Committee on Transportation, Subcommittee on Transportation Economic Development, open a public hearing on 5070. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What we're doing today is overviewing the fees that are in the department's fee ratification bill. These are fees that the agency established during the interim by administrative rule that need to be ratified by the legislature. Otherwise, they will go back to the fee that they were prior to the administrative rule change. The fee bill that you have before you contains only one fee increase. That's the plate registration fee. There are additional fees that were adopted during the interim that will need to be amended into the bill, and those are the highway access management fees, the rail fixed guideway safety oversight and regulatory fee, pack and load registration fee, unsolicited proposals fees, and the pilot program road user fee. I've also included for your information so that we can talk about all the fees at one time is the snow park permit fees. It's not required in this bill because the agency hasn't actually adopted a fee increase, but they're recommending one and have a policy package in their budget. And so I've included it in the staff measure summary for your information. So with that, I invite the agency to the table to go through those fees for your information.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bruce Warner, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Before I turn it over to Mike to go through the fees, I thought I'd just advise, for the record, that the committee did have a few questions from their meeting yesterday. They had some questions about Amtrak, the funding for Metropolitan Planning Organization, tie gates, and some questions about access management. And I wanted to let the committee know that we're working on those answers. I would bring them to you and have them to you by this time, but we're doing a little more work, and those will be available Monday. And we are working with Senator Johnson on her tie gate issues and with Senator Berger in her office on the access issue. So with that, I think I'll turn it right over with the chair. Concurrence to Mike Marsh and start walking through our fee issues.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Mike Marsh from ODOT. Here to go through the fee proposals. And as Susie was indicating, these fees have been implemented and we're coming back for approval. The first one is the DMV plate registration fee. And if you're following Susie's list, it shows that fee. And then we'll go through each one of the different seven fees briefly. This one relates back to House Bill 2041 from the 03 legislative session, and it deleted longstanding statutory language that related to the DMV plate registration fee amounts. And these fees have been established as amounts shown from $2 to $3 for a single plate, and for a pair of plates it's from $3 to $5. No limitation is necessary, and there's no additional impact in terms of positions from this action. Mr. Chair, I'll go on to the second one, if that's okay.
Please do.
The second one is access management fee. This is in the Highway Division, and these are fees that were established by ODOT in administrative rule after discussion at the last legislative session about changes in access management. The previous fee was $50 per application, and due to the complexity of work, growth in Oregon, concerns about making sure we covered a larger percentage of the cost of the work that was done in planning and looking at access. We've come up with a different fee schedule to change the one that was established in 1983. So what is here is the result of some survey work done with local governments, survey with other states to determine what would be an appropriate rate compared to the different kinds of work that is done from single-family residences all the way up through large developments. The fee schedule starts at a $200 level for the small requests, and those deal mainly with single-family residences or other small requests, all the way up to greater than 10,000 vehicle trips per day, which at the rate would be $5,000. We're recognizing that this is only a percentage of the overall costs that actually are undergone in order to evaluate these requests, and we're thinking it's between 25 and 35% of the overall costs. But it does at least move from a minimal fee that existed before that didn't recognize the amount of work that needed to be done to do the work on access. I also ought to mention that we reported to the November Emergency Board on the customer satisfaction, customer service elements of access management, and we could certainly go into that if members had questions.
Representative, or Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yesterday in the testimony when I was chatting with Mr. Greenleaf about access management, and he was talking about, at least certainly left the impression, that life had gotten simpler in that arena. And I'm curious, if things are simpler and the access management is mostly a creation of ODOT, in order to deal with access management issues, and I don't diminish how important that is, but I'm trying to figure out how, if it's gotten simpler, the fee increase structure reconcile those two things for me.
Sure. Maybe I can start and then go to Bruce. The overall picture is that it's gotten simpler because we did get the fee implemented over a year ago, and we do have a structure for the access management process that we believe is now working, and customers are indicating they're feeling like it's gone favorably. But if Bruce wanted to go into more detail, or if he had more question, we're happy to do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, if I could also respond. I think the word simpler is relates to maybe Mr. Greenleaf's observation of his involvement and his need to mediate and deal with some of the issues that have come up. I think what he really is trying to say is we put a lot of effort into this over the last 4.5 years. We have revised and simplified our rules, but if you and again, I believe made it more clear and objective, and had the ability to actually get to an answer more quickly. However, as you heard, the fees had been established in 1983 and hadn't been adjusted since then. And frankly, we never were able to deal with the difference between a single family and a large commercial development. And as you would suspect, there's major differences of activity. So we'll be monitoring the dollars to do this on a regular basis, and we would propose changes in the fees if it looks like the costs are less than we actually anticipated.
Thank you.
I have a question for you. Not having heard any of the prior testimony that was made, what cost is it to the department for a single-family home to gain access, and what's the range of one that has 10,000 paper trips per day?
Mr. Chair, what I would suggest is that when we talk about our accesses to permit, the majority of them are single-family residences. They're looking a driveway to a state highway. And in those cases, the things that we need to do are, obviously, we need to do a site visit. We need to review the zoning and applications to determine, again, the level of traffic and what's going to be going on to that individual driveway. And we need to check the legal descriptions. We need the right legal descriptions for the actual grant of that driveway. And again, prepare the actual written permit itself and go through the review process as described by the administrative rule. So I think what you're seeing is the fee we have, I believe, is $200. Is that it for a single-family residence? And I think what we're saying, if you look at the dollars, that's probably covering about 25% of the actual cost of doing that work, if I'm responsive to your question. And obviously, on a major development, you need to essentially, work with the developer, the engineer, to determine the types of development, the traffic generation. Usually, it involves more than one access. It involves could involve signalization, could involve other mitigation that would need technical review and design work from our standpoint as well as that of the private sector. So, when we get into those type of developments, there's a lot more work and a lot more activities that go on, and those are the ones where oftentimes we have to work hand in hand with the city, the developer, and the property owner to move the things forward, and it just takes a whole lot more time and effort than obviously a single family residence would, if I'm getting to the point of your question.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if there aren't other questions on that one, we'll move to the next one, which is rail fixed guideway safety. This relates to a very small number of entities that are regulated within Oregon. It deals in Oregon with TriMet, Portland Street Car, Astoria Trolley, and the Willamette Shore Trolley. We're required by the federal government to have a independent safety and security program and to have a independent fee that covers the cost from working with these contractors. It was established through a revenue source to recover program costs in this case, and what we have is basically split according to the size of the work that needs to be done. About 78% of the cost goes to TriMet, 20% to Portland Street Car, and 1% each to Astoria Trolley and Willamette Shore Trolley. And these positions were already approved in the 2003 legislative sessions, and this has been implemented, so just a matter of approving that implementation. There are no questions on that one. We'll move on to the next one, which is...
Mr. Marsh, before you move ahead, I hate to disclose my appalling lack of functional knowledge of your terminology, but what is a funicular?
It's the connection that you have on the streetcar to the cable.
Oh, cool.
So that's what that kind of equipment means.
I thought you were just trying to dazzle us with these big, complicated words.
I could have said fiduciary, too, but I won't do that one either.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions on the guideway? Thank you. Pack and load registration, we could have similar questions about that one. What is a pack and load? Pack and load registration authorized fees. There are two kinds of movers. There's a mover that many of you may have used where a motor carrier comes in with a truck, pulls up in front of the house and unloads your furniture, etc., puts it into the truck and drives off and hopefully delivers it to your next residence. The other kind of carrier, which we're talking about here, is not a regulated motor carrier, but does packing and loading and comes in. You get the truck. They come by, load the vehicle, pack up the things that need to be packed into boxes, and put it onto the vehicle. Then you drive off. So it's a different kind of registration, and there have been problems in the past. ODOT was trying to go for a little less regulatory approach, but there was an interest in making sure that this was actually regulated as an industry. And so that did pass the 2003 legislative session, and fees were established in order to cover the costs of working with this group and ensuring the regulation that was directed by the legislature. And so that's what's before you now, is a recognition that there are no new positions required, that there is a fee of $100 for pack and load providers, and an initial application fee of $200 per the legislative direction. And if there are no questions on that one, Mr. Chair, I'll move on to the fees to accompany unsolicited proposals for our innovative partnerships program for public-private partnerships. I think the members will recall in the 2003 legislative session there was quite a bit of discussion about innovative partnerships and ensuring that ODOT could move into the same realm as a couple other states that are allowing for proposals to come forward unsolicited from the private sector to seek to do highway and infrastructure projects. The fees that we're talking about here would relate to two different types. Those that are over $100 million proposals would have a fee of $5,000, and those that are over $100 million would have a fee $20,000, pardon me. And the fact is that we've had some contacts from people who have interest in doing this work. As time moves forward, there's a wild estimate that we might have between 3 and 6 unsolicited proposals in the next biennium. It's hard to tell how many will be coming forward. But the fact is we want to make sure that when folks bring these forward, there is going to be a significant interest in a complete proposal, and that's why I want to have some fee there, because we are going to have to do some work to evaluate those proposals.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I just want to make sure that I understand this correctly, Mike. I come up with the world's greatest idea to solve the world's oldest problem, and it's over $100 million in solution, and I send you my plan, and for you to review my plan and deem it worthy of consideration will cost me $20,000.
That's correct, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson.
What about, I understand these big deals that have to be analyzed thoughtfully, but I reflect back on my days at ODOT, and there was a thing called blue light or blue star, and I don't remember exactly what happened. It was some kind of special reflector. And I think of the jillions of hours that were involved in looking at that proposal. I would assume that it is appropriate for you to have some kind of analyst expense reimbursed. But what about all the little ones that I think could suck up just about as much time and energy and being lobbied and asked to have ODOT carry it forward to the legislature for consideration? What do you do about those unsolicited proposals?
Maybe I should help separate out, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, proposals that are innovative partnerships from other ones which would deal with products, like what the Senator is talking about. in this case, we're talking about infrastructure projects, which would have significant legal, engineering, enforcement, and other concerns that have to be evaluated. So our view would be that these are going to be significant projects that are coming forward. There aren't going to be that many very small projects. In other words, the ones that maybe involve an exchange don't have to be an innovative partnership. They could be something that comes forward through a regular RFP process, and that's really the emphasis, and I probably should have said that in the beginning, that our emphasis on the public-private partnership program will be those that are our initiative solicited proposals. The ones that come forward that are unsolicited are going to be, in the case of other states anyway, in their experience, larger proposals that weren't on the priority list for the state, like in Virginia, where they've had more of these, and where an idea comes forward to say, we're going to do this great new thing that you hadn't thought of or wasn't high on your priority list. Does that help, Senator?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if there are no further questions on the unsolicited proposals, we'll go to the last one that requires approval at this point, which is the Road User Fee Pilot Program. This is looking at the Road User Fee Task Force and the implementation per the 2001 legislation that requires us to explore an alternative to the vehicle fuels tax. We've been doing work to prepare that process. There's been a task force working on this subject, and we're now getting close to negotiating with service stations to have alternative fee approach used. It'll be mainly in the Portland area, and there'll be approximately 300 volunteers that will be participating in the program. In order to have this work, though, we have to charge a mileage fee, which is the beginning of a vehicle miles traveled fee, and it's part of the pilot for this program. What this, this allows us to do is to charge that fee so that the volunteers that sign up can have a fee in place of the gas tax so we can implement the pilot program. And, Mr. Chair, the last one is the snow park permit fee increase, which is mentioned by Susie and was discussed by Doug Tindall in the package discussion yesterday. But if there are any questions about the snow park element, we're happy to hit those, too.
Committee, nothing? No. Thank you, then. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator
Bricker.
That's all
right. It's all right. I think I would like to just take advantage of this and having to make some comments about fees. We call them a fee. You call them a fee. The public calls them a tax. I think that the public has a very disgruntled attitude about fees. They feel that they pay taxes, therefore we should run government on those taxes, and that there's a way that every time we want more money, we increase fees. And I just want to raise that to the TV screen here because I believe that that conversation and discussion needs to take place. Those of us who are out in public life and come for sessions to make public policy and then have to go back out and work in the public who are really impacted by a lot of the fees. State parks, for instance, we increased, if you remember, the fee. Many people in our area felt that that was all a part of being an Oregonian, was to be able to use the parks. I'm just looking at the snow park. And I know what you're facing exactly. I just want to tell you that this does not play well for policymakers that have to go out and work with the public and try to explain why we have to have fees and why does government cost so much. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Director Warner, we've got one person signed up for public testimony, but I'd like to give you an opportunity to make any comments you'd like to regarding the policy packages.
No, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have nothing more. I think Mike did a very good job of going through the fees. Obviously, I understand the concern of Senator Berger with fees. We are trying to look at our fee schedules and make them as equitable and reflect the value that will be received by folks from those fees. Again, it's a package of fees that we need and should move forward with. So again, I have nothing further than that.
Senator Johnson.
I guess the one last thing that I'd say about the access management, and that's one I'm struggling with, particularly with regard to some of the mandated traffic studies that are required. So if I'm coming in trying to do a shopping mall, for example, and it's greater than 10,000 vehicle trips per day, I pay a fee. then I'm not sure under what terms and conditions I would also have to provide the, you know, it seems like the ubiquitous Kittleson traffic study is required almost any time anybody does anything. And I'm trying to figure how much more burden comes on me with respect to doing the traffic study that I have to present in addition to the $5,000 fee, which, regardless of the fact that they haven't been changed since the 80s, still is a move up from $50 to $5,000, and now I get to buy the traffic study on top of it. How does that work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I'll try to respond to that. The question is right on because, you know, we try to work very closely with the local governments, so and we have, on occasion, asked for traffic impact studies when, frankly, as a result of some of the fees that people are paying, we should be able to generate that same type of information ourselves. So I've had, as I think some of the staff in here would tell you, some long discussions with when we actually require a traffic impact study or not, because oftentimes the results are pretty obvious in terms of what the traffic generation is. We don't need a traffic consultant to do the work for us. So what we're trying to do, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, is work with the cities, the counties, the people who actually have to do the land use approvals, and dovetail with them. So if they require a traffic impact study, then essentially we work together to make sure the information that is prepared for that development to meet the city's requirements also meets the requirements of the Oregon Department of Transportation. We're not having to do things twice. That's one of the things. The other thing is we're essentially saying at certain levels we do not require those traffic impact studies to be done, and we do it as part of the overall fee that we're charging to do this work.
If the chair will allow me to just dial in on this a little bit tighter. So you're saying if this fee schedule is approved, one could expect a concomitant reduction in the requirement of the traffic impact studies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, these fees are not the reason we're talking about the changes in the way when we require or do not require a traffic impact study. What I'm telling you is the work that's going on in parallel with this, which is the process that goes on to actually accomplish giving an access permit. We're making major strides to reduce the paperwork and streamline the process so that we're not asking for redundant or duplicative work as we move forward. And so I guess I'm telling you that's my commitment to you. And if you're hearing otherwise, again, these fees have been in place now since when, Mr. Marsh?
A little over a year.
A little over a year. And I think it's worked very, very successfully, and I've actually had nobody complain to me about the fees. So I think we're doing a pretty good job in meeting the expectations. And I think the bigger thing is people want the service, and we're delivering on that service, I think, is what our surveys have shown. And so the customers are satisfied with what they're getting. So I think it's a good balance right at the moment, Senator.
I guess just to beat this horse absolutely to death, the only other comment I would make is ODOT enforces the access management program on folks and then makes them pay to figure out how to get through the bureaucracy attached to access management. And frequently, the only two times that I hear about ODOT, somebody's been treated shabbily at the DMV window, or it's about the blank-blank access management program. And I'm just trying to figure out, do you add insult to injury by saying the program exists and now we're moving the fee structure way up to make sure that people making application can pay for something imposed on them by ODOT? And it probably doesn't beg a response.
And smart to not give one when given the opportunity. Thank you. Beth Royce?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
With your permission, while the witness is coming up, Senator Morse and I have some special guests. And with your leave, could we introduce them?
Please.
I have two young women who are visiting the United States from Italy. They've been on an extended exchange program. And I'd like to introduce Francesca. If you'd stand up, Francesca. And Eleonora. And then they're here with two of their colleagues from St. Helens, Chris and Cody, and have been pages today on the floor of the Senate, and we've appreciated their help, and I've had the privilege of being Francesca's host at a couple of events, and she's been a charming young lady, and I wish you the very best.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank you for acknowledging these guests, Senator. And I have a guest, Dave Cruz from Lafayette Middle School in Albany, and he was a page, honorary page today on the floor. and he served us well. Thank you.
That is terrific. Thank you for recognizing them, and welcome to the Capitol and to our committee. Ms. Royce, and welcome to you, too. Thank you for making the trip here from Bend.
Thank you. I have a written statement, and I don't know where you want that. I have a few copies. Thank you. Well, I thank you for the opportunity of being able to speak with the committee this afternoon. My name is Beth Royce, and I represent the Winter Recreation Advisory Committee, which is an advisory committee to the Oregon Department of Transportation. The seven members of our committee are winter recreationalists, and we're required to represent different areas of the public concern, and they are a member from the Oregon Snowmobile Association, a member from the Oregon Nordic Club. There are two members from the public at large, one of whom is Betsy Belshaw in the audience today to give me a little moral support. I represent the Pacific Northwest Ski Association, so the downhill skiers and snowboarders. I'm also a snowshoer. There are also two ski area operators who belong to our committee, and one is from Ski Anthony Lakes and the other is from Mount Hood Meadows. So we represent, I think, all of winter recreation, or we certainly try to. We support the snow park program, and we're very concerned about the program right now. We are asking that you approve the increase in the permit fees. And I hope that I can convince Senator Berger and the rest of the committee that we really are trying to look out for the public and look at these fees. To a member on our committee, we are very reluctant to ever increase the fees or ask for an increase in the permit fees. Over the years, we have tried to examine the cost of snow removal, and we've asked the state to provide us with information about the cost to remove snow as far as even the hourly rate for equipment used, both by the state and by the private contractors that we work with. We also are very concerned about making the permits easy and accessible for the public to get so that we have good sales, because that's our only source of income. We also review our enforcement programs, because, of course, that keeps people buying the permits if they know they get that ticket. We do ask that you approve this increase for fees. We know that we compare ourselves to the other states around us, and we have always been well below the amount of fees that are charged in Washington, California, and Idaho. We do have reciprocal agreements with them, so we feel we're providing a good value and that we are doing a good job. The seven members of this committee, we kind of feel that we are watchdogs. We try to really look out for the public. We want all our snow parks to stay open. The past couple of years, we've been holding our breath, so to speak. We barely had enough in our fund that if we had a normal snow year, we would maybe break even. This past year, I think if we'd had a normal snow year, and you know that we didn't, I don't think we'd be breaking even this summer. I think we are going to just find we're breaking even. We don't want to find ourselves in a position where we have to decide what snow parks are going to be closed. Even the biggest ski area operators in Oregon want all the parks to stay open, no matter how small they are. We want all the parks open. We want all Oregonians to be able to enjoy a good outdoor recreation opportunity, and all the visitors who come to Oregon as well. I think that's my statement.
You just said that you want all Oregonians to be able to enjoy a good outdoor opportunity. What if I can't afford the snowpack fee?
Well, the structure of how the fund or how the snowpark system is funded, you know, I can't comment on. I've been handed that. The only money that's available to clear snowparks comes from this fund.
Thank you.
All I can say is that we're concerned and we're trying to watch and keep the fees as low as possible. We hesitate to ask for increases in the fees.
The point I'm trying to make, Mr. Chair, is just for some folks, a trip up to the mountains might be the only winter recreation they're able to partake of. They can't afford to ski. They can't afford to have snowmobiles. And to find out that it costs to have the permit to even go up may put the outdoor winter recreation experience out of the reach of folks. And I just think we have to be cognizant of that.
And I understand your concern, and we have that same concern. But right now, we are not asking for any fee to the daily fee, which is still
$3. Well, if you could, I just want to make sure we're very clear on your point. Without the fee increase, the result will be what to you?
Well, we know fuel costs are going up. General costs have gone up as well. So I certainly, we have a great concern that next year we will not be able to maintain all the parks being open if we have a normal snow year. Of course, it varies greatly from year to year. So we always have to be a little prepared for the worst case scenario. We try to maintain enough in the fund that we can always easily meet a normal snow year.
And they can't, if I could interrupt you, and when you say that all the parks won't be open, what does that mean?
If we run out of money, we run out of money. If we can't service all the parks, then we've been asked previously by the Department of Transportation, could we help them decide what parks will be closed if we run out of money? Because we have been dangerously closed several times.
For those of us who aren't as familiar as you with what a closure means, does that mean you put a gate up in front of the road so nobody can get in because it's not serviced? Or does it mean it's not staffed? Or
it means the road is not cleared.
Okay.
The snow is not cleared out of the park.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize if this was addressed and I was not present. What is the fund balance if it's deemed to be inadequate?
Our year end is July 1st, so we won't truly know. A lot of the expenses still come in during the months of May and June, but I can refer you to the Department of Transportation for more accurate numbers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the agency actually provided that information to me, and over the last two biennia, the ending balances have averaged about $600,000. So they go into the next biennium with about somewhere between $558,000 and $710,000, depends on how much their expenditure was during the year. They actually average about $1.2 million in revenue collections each biennium. I'm sorry, $2.8 million per biennium.
$2.8 million under the current fee structure.
Yes.
And my question is that since we've had an exceptionally light snow year, and this budget likely was prepared prior to the eventual play out of the winter, what kind of expanded balances do we have or anticipated? And is, in fact, this request...
What we anticipate, I believe, for this year is that we'll have an ending balance in a light snow year. That's what we started with at the beginning of the year. So, in other words, if we'd had really a normal snow year or a bigger than average snow year, we would have been in trouble.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the agency is actually projecting about $758,000 in ending balance for this biennium going into the next biennium. The prior biennium, it was about $500,000 and almost $600,000.
And it's a little tricky because when we sell our snow park permits, we try to sell lots of season permits at the beginning of the year because those are the more expensive ones. But if the snow, if there is no snow at the beginning of the year, everyone waits and they don't buy a season permit. So then later in the year, they're only going to buy a three-day permit or a one-day permit. It really changes the amount of our income, how the snow flies.
It'd be helpful to know, and Ms. Rice, if you can't answer it, if Director, you or one of your staff can, why it is that that $600,000 or $700,000 balance that rolls over can't accommodate the type of situation you're talking about where you can't get a road cleared?
We try to maintain at least a balance there that would help us get through a maximum snow year.
Mr. Chair, I think Doug Tindall can probably answer the question better than I can, but the response that I received from the agency on that is when they don't just clear the roads, they also do some repair to roads. And in a heavy snow year, all they can accommodate is clearing the snow out. They can't get in and fix the potholes or damage to the road because of the snow and ice freeze during the winter. In a medium snow year, they can clear the road and they can do some of the repairs to the road, and then in a light they can get in and actually do both. Their expenditures this last biennium, you know, for the first year it was like $1.4 million in this season it's approaching about $700,000, so they're able to do a little bit more repair. So Doug, if you want to add to that.
Yeah, Mr. Tindall, come up and just, you know, we won't go much longer on the topic, but just so we can get right to the heart of the question, it seems to me that the the most important thing would be to keep the access open, like you described. And if you're sitting there with a road that's closed and you don't have access, that's like the ultimate problem for you. If you've got $700,000 sitting in the bank, explain to the committee why that amount of money is not enough money to address that problem.
Sure. Chair Avakian, members of the committee, good afternoon. Doug Tindall, Deputy Director of the Department of Transportation. The issue is, I have to take you back to 1999 when this account was essentially broke. And what had happened to us in that situation is we went through two severe winters in a row. So we've tried to build the balance up. Actually, Ms. Jordan is sort of correct. We've done a very minimal amount of surface repair because we've tried to build the balance up so that we can absorb two consecutive winters where we have snow on an everyday basis in order to keep these open. That's where we're at right now. That's all the money that's in there now. And as Ms. Royce indicated, we're just taking in enough now to keep it where it's at, even in this light of winter. And Ms. Jordan, I think we may be under that $758,000 given the recent snow that we've had in March. But even as light a winter as this is, we're not building up a balance. So our target would be to keep the balance about where it is, allow us to make sure we can get through two consecutive years and be able to do some of those surface repairs, which is allowed under the law when there is a balance. The thing about the surface repair is that your cost to plow can go up if you don't have a good surface. That's why the balance is where it's at. That's why we targeted it for that, and that's why we need the fee increase now.
Okay, Senator Johnson.
I'm just trying to understand, Doug, why it is that you'd be doing road repairs with money that is ostensibly plow the road money.
Chair Avakian and Senator Johnson, it's specifically allowed in statute that a balance from this fund, this activity and this property is not eligible for highway fund expenditure.
Why?
Because it's not a road open for public travel.
It's the public driving in, though.
Chair Avakian and Senator Johnson, I would defer to my friends at the Department of Justice to explain to you why parking lots aren't constitutionally allowable for the use of highway funds. But
okay,
I can assure you that they've told me that they aren't, yes.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
So describe for some of us how this works. I'm driving up to one of the ski areas on Mount Hood, and I know where the pullout areas are that are adjacent to the highways, but you're telling me now that the snowplow would go into Ski Bowl's parking lot and do Ski Bowl's parking lot?
Chair Avakian, Senator Johnson, that's correct. In some of those areas up there, we actually contract with the area to do the snow removal.
But what I'm trying to figure out is Ski Bowl, and I'm not picking on Ski Bowl, it's just one I can think of quickly. Ski Bowl is a private for-profit company. Why is it then that it is the public paying fees to use a public parking lot adjacent to a private ski area? How does that work?
Chair Avakian, Senator Johnson, that's the way the snow park program or winter recreation program was established. It is a for-profit venture on Forest Service land, I believe. And the way it was, the program was set up allowed designation of snow parking areas, of which Ski Bowl and Timberline and Meadows are all included.
Many of the users who would go up to play in those ski areas are not necessarily downhill skiers and would not necessarily be using the ski area itself. So they provide parking for the public who does not use their recreation opportunity as well. They might be cross-country skiers or just snow tubers or...
I want to vet out just a little bit more this reserve money, because I'm not exactly sure how you're characterizing it. Let's say the increase does not occur, and December rolls around, people are ready to go up for their Christmas skiing trip, and the roads are closed. Do you dip into the $700,000, or do you not dip into it because you want to keep it for the next year?
Chair Avakian, we will spend the money that's available in order to keep the snow parks open for as long as possible.
Okay.
The point is, at the point where the money runs out, there is no option, and you're out of money simply, and you can no longer plow.
Right. Understood. Committee, anything else? Ms. Royce, thank you. That was very helpful to the committee. We appreciate you coming and testifying. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 5070? Certainly, come on up. And if you could, just state your name for the record, and why don't you tell us where you're from, and then just proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tammy Denny. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. I reside in Umatilla County, and the office of the Oregon Wheat Growers League is located in that county. I'll read from my prepared remarks and then be available to answer any questions that the committee might have at the conclusion of these remarks.
Thank you.
The Oregon Wheat Growers League is a grassroots association which represents approximately 4,000 wheat and barley producers from throughout the state, just a small subset of Oregon's 40,000 farmers. The association was established in 1926 by a small group of producers and continues today as a grower-funded, grower-directed entity located in Pendleton, Oregon. I appear before you today to speak on behalf of the Oregon Department of Transportation's General Fund Appropriation. Over the past 3 years, the Oregon Wheat Growers League has been actively engaged in numerous cooperative efforts with the staff of the Oregon Department of Transportation to educate growers regarding the nuances specific to regulations governing farm truck safety. It has been through these activities that the League has grown to trust and respect the Oregon Department of Transportation. Several examples of the issues that have forged this strong working relationship include creations of a handbook, which I provided to you today, a copy. This handbook was created to help describe for producers compliance issues for interstate and intrastate commerce, reciprocity issues for movement of farm commodities into Washington State, and establishing kiosks for growers to obtain necessary trip permits, which were once provided at ports of entry by Washington State Police. Ancillary road closures affecting access to secondary roads, restricting movement of farm machinery to nearby fields. Continued distribution of F-plates in local DMV offices. ODOT staff participation in educational workshop regarding farm truck safety regulations, and one that I did not note in my written comments but remembered during my travels here this morning, load securement was a large issue that came into play about a year ago. The beginning of the working relationship between the League and the Department stems from the 2003 legislative session, when the Oregon farm community lost their longstanding exemption in Oregon revised statutes from safety regulations when operating their trucks in interstate commerce. This occurred in response to a federal audit in which USDOT determined the farm exemption was a disqualifying circumstance that would preclude Oregon from continuing to receive the Motor Carrier Safety federal grant of $4.6 million a biennium. Oregon Speaker of the House Karen Menes was very involved in the discussions between the farm community, ODOT, and USDOT. At the end of the 2003 session, an agreement was struck whereby ODOT safety regulatory staff would work very closely with the League and the Oregon Farm Bureau to keep us fully apprised of any proposed or actual changes in the safety regulatory environment. The basis of the farm community's acquiescence to the statutory revision in the 03 session that removed our long-standing safety exemption was the assurance that ODOT would direct the work of the law enforcement agencies in Oregon aimed at truck safety regulation. This is now reflected in Oregon statute. Unfortunately, the reality for the wheat industry is that the matters of regulatory enforcement relevant to interstate commerce lie within the purview of the U.S. Department of Transportation. Although it has been confirmed through an internal audit conducted within USDOT that Oregon producers are being more heavily regulated than producers in the rest of the United States, the heavy-handed regulatory enforcement of USDOT continues in Oregon. A major accomplishment following the 03 legislative session was the result of a cooperative effort of ODOT, the League, the Farm Bureau, the Association of Nurseries, and the local office of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration to craft the handbook, which I've given you a copy of. The handbook, several thousand copies, were distributed throughout the state to producers in several venues of agriculture. This handbook was published at ODOT's expense and distributed to the grower organizations at no charge. The purpose of the handbook was to assist growers by simplifying and summarizing the voluminous and often technical federal motor carrier safety regs to which farmers are now subject when operating in interstate commerce. Growers have responded to the receipt of the handbooks and continue to work towards compliance. Unfortunately, the goal of compliance is nearly unattainable as local USDOT staff continues to change the definitions relative to compliance. It is necessary for the committee to understand the issues concerning onerous regulations are being applied by USDOT to producers who deliver their commodities within the state of Oregon to destinations where the final delivery point is unknown. This type of movement is defined as interstate commerce, which is regulated by USDOT. ODOT's authority is specific to commodities moved in intrastate commerce. The OWGL continues to seek relief in Washington, D.C. from the onerous regulations pertinent to interstate commerce, but thus far has been unsuccessful. The majority of Oregon wheat producers haul their own grain to the local upcountry or terminal elevator or to the local flour mill. If they move grain from the field to the local flour mill, it is deemed intrastate commerce governed by ODOT. If growers transport grain in the very same truck to the local elevator or river terminal, it is deemed interstate commerce governed by USDOT. As the final destination of the grain when moved down the river to the Port of Portland for export is unknown. At either destination, elevator or flour mill, the title of the grain is transferred when the grain is delivered and the grower no longer controls the shipment or transfer of that grain. Nonetheless, the historic ruling of the Interstate Commerce Commission designating grain moving to the river terminals to be the first movement in a continuing movement in which the fixed and persisting intent is exportation, then the entire movement is interstate commerce. At the conclusion of the last Washington State legislative session, the Washington State Police budgets were cut and services eliminated. One of those services was the distribution of trip permits at ports of entry for Oregon growers moving commodity into Washington State. When the ODOT staff learned of this loss of reciprocal agreement, they were quick to call upon their counterparts in Washington State to request assistance in establishing an alternative method for growers to obtain the necessary documents to continue moving their commodities into Washington. Today, there are three kiosks available to growers, and additional efforts are underway to ensure adequate kiosks are available near all major ports of entry. ODOT staff has been quick to address closures of ancillary roads, which affect access to secondary roads, which have restricted movement of farm machinery to nearby fields. The ODOT staff has been very willing to listen to the perspective of the affected producers and have taken appropriate action, resulting in mutually agreeable solutions. Very recently, the Department of Motor Vehicles was considering discontinuing the distribution of farm plates in their local field offices due to staff confusion of which farmers were appropriate to distribute these farm plates to. ODOT staff was instrumental in orchestrating conversations between myself and the DMV director. As a result of these conversations, DMV has decided to continue providing this service to the farm community. Without the expertise and willingness of ODOT staff to assist in bringing the affected parties together, the results would have been much different, and growers would have lost a very important service in rural field offices. As to the issue of load securement, as I mentioned, about a year ago, it came to our attention in a very unfortunate incident where a producer was moving commodity through a port of entry from Klamath Falls into California and was treated rather rudely regarding his load securement. When we were notified, and then I had a conversation with ODOT staff, they were quick to assist in helping us to understand what compliance where new load securement regs were concerned. Oregon Wheat Growers League truly appreciates Director Warner, Greg Delpani, and David McCain for their efforts in assisting our association in helping to understand the nuances that surround the regulations that do affect our producers. Thank you very much for your attention today and for allowing me to appear before your committee, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Denny. Senator Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank you for your presentation today. I especially want to thank you for recognizing the hard work that people work with you in partnership in your job. But, Mr. Chair, I want to compliment Tammy, who Oregon wheat growers are very lucky to have her, because she not only represents them well, I think she has a real sincere interest in all of rural Oregon and is very open to helping other areas of the state, and I want to publicly thank you for that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, thank you very much.
I am going to assume, because of the content of your testimony, that it probably was not related to any of the fee policy packages that we just heard.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry to interrupt you. That's absolutely correct. Until I walked into the committee hearing today, I had not analyzed any of the specificity of the request pertinent to any fee increases or requests for fee increases, so I'm not prepared to make any comment as to the fee increases.
Don't worry, I wasn't going to ask you about any of them. I just wanted, we really welcome your testimony. Thanks for giving it, and we'll just make sure that it's under the appropriate bill, or just generally with regard to ODOT. Committee, anything else? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Denny.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who would like to testify on House Bill 5070, which is the bill related to the proposed fees? Okay, seeing none, then what I will do is close the public hearing on House Bill.
Before
I'm
you
sorry,
leave this piece, a question either for Mr. March or Director Warner, if you would indulge it.
Why don't you two come back up to the table, because you will be there shortly anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In looking over this menu of fee increases, I'm just trying to get a sense of what's the fallback position. If any of this suite of fee increases does not secure sufficient votes on the panel to move forward, what's the fallback?
Mr. Chair, maybe I can start. Mike Marsh from ODOT. Each one of these has been implemented, and so we've started charging the fee on the basis of the approval from coming out of the last session. So it is, of course, up to the legislative session per Senate Bill 333 to say that these are not now approved, and we can go back. What would be required to occur is to stop charging the fees, and then to work with the Attorney General's office to determine what happens for fees that have been already paid. And whether that means having to do some kind of reimbursement or not. We have not followed through on whether that's a required element of these fees, but that would be one of the questions. And then for the future, it would mean that we would be covering those elements that could be covered within highway fund is one component, but most of the fees we're talking about cannot be covered within highway fund. Actually, I think every one of them cannot be covered within highway fund. So then it becomes a problem of figuring out how we're going to deal with providing the service. In some areas, we have some flexibility. In others, there's no flexibility to perform the function without highway fund.
Thank you.
Senator Berger.
Yes, I don't want to appear cold-hearted and lack of understanding here, but I guess that the process worries me that fees are increased in this way. I'm sure this is the right process that you follow, but then you implement the fees, and then you come to us to say to ratify the fees, and somehow this process doesn't suit my personality. I would feel a lot more comfortable if you came and said, these are the fees we'd like to implement. Do you think these are good fees? And so having said that, tell me how long you've been doing it this way.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, Senate Bill 333 is what required the change in this process. Last session, in the 2003 session, for instance, most of the fees that you're seeing here were discussed in program option packages with similar members to yourselves in Ways and Means. So they approved positions, they approved expenditure limitation, and they approved a conceptual fee to go out and establish to pay for those positions. In virtually every case, we discussed about how much it would cost in order to implement that fee, and communicated that and got the approval. Senate Bill 333 requires that we come back and get the precise approval for the fee after the fact, and I'm not going to jump in the position of a policymaker here about what the Senate bill was trying to get at, but I think it was a ratification process to ensure that the actual final fee was before you. But our view as agencies is that we share fully the expected fee and the expenditure limitation and the amount of money we need to receive in terms of revenue and get a policy decision at that level.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair. So, obviously, there was either some little breakdown in communication, if indeed they thought that these fees were appropriate. I'm so glad you said that it was the Ways and Means. This is my first time on Ways and Means, so I'm not going to let this touch me. But I think another thing that I want to complain about while I have my list here, and that is that they're all in one package. In other words, here it is, and accept all the fees or are not. I think that the access management fee takes me by surprise. It just takes me back. So I would have to tell you that you've moved access management to the highway fund. That's a change to begin with, but this didn't bring about that fee increase, did it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Virger, no, this was part of the discussion of the package and process in the 03 session and then at the emergency board. And maybe I could ask the Budget Management Division to comment on the structure of the budget in terms of decision packages, if that was okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I would do that. And then, Ms. Jordan, you had something to add to.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Christina Shearer, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. To address Senator Verger's comment about all the fees being in one package, I will indicate that is a standard budgetary process or procedure that we utilize in all agencies to limit the number of policy packages that the committee has to deal with. In the case of ODOT, it results in several fees being in one package. In most agencies, it's usually a smaller number of fees.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to clarify for the record that access management fees were not discussed in the 0305 Ways and Means process, nor were the fee element discussed to the emergency board when the report came forward about the quality of service in the survey that was required by Ways and Means. So the fee structure itself wasn't discussed. And it wasn't discussed in this, that they were going to a graduated structure in that process. So you haven't had this before you before. The fact that they appear in one bill does not preclude the subcommittee from recommending to the full committee that one or more of those fees not be ratified. And I don't believe that. I'm not a lawyer, so I'd have to check with legislative counsel on this, but administrative rules are the rule of law at the time that they're in place, and so there wouldn't have to be a reimbursement of those fees that were already collected. The agency acted in good faith, went through an administrative rule process with public hearings and feedback from the public on whether or not that was an appropriate fee structure to adopt, and then adopted those rules through a legal process. Therefore, you have the ability to make changes. The policy packages, when they come forward to you, will come forward in program areas or as separate packages, so you have an ability to adopt those or not.
Senator Johnson.
It is still your prerogative.
I think perhaps we're transmitting to you guys some uneasiness about the access, particularly the access management fee. It is my understanding that in any rulemaking there is an advisory committee, or at least generally that's the case, comprised of affected persons or interested persons. When you worked the rulemaking, was there an advisory group convened around the access management element?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I believe there was an advisory group on access management that gave feedback regarding the rule. Is that a correct statement? Yes, it is.
Okay, then taking that with your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
If you're going to go further, Mr. Tyndall, do you want to just take a seat up at the table?
Go ahead.
And then please continue.
I would be very interested in knowing how comprehensive the record is on the deliberations that were conducted by that advisory group around the issue of access management. It's one of the dicier issues that I think we all deal with in relationship to constituent complaints, and I would very much think that it would be of interest to the panel to know who all was there, what all were the limits of the discussions, was there an opportunity for public testimony beyond just the existence of the advisory board offering their opinions, if you could share with us.
Chair Vakian, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director, Senator Johnson, I wasn't at that time, that was not under highway, that was then under transportation development, so I'm going to tell you what I can remember.
I understand what you just said. It wasn't under highway, it was under transportation development.
That's correct. When we adopted the rule, but let me just tell you a little bit about the rule adoption. There was the Access Management Advisory Committee that resulted in the first rule. There was Access Management Advisory Committee 2 that resulted in the second rule. So this has had extensive public involvement, and I'd be more than happy to bring you all of the people, the cast of thousands that were involved in those discussions. And it wasn't only about the fees, it was about the entire structure of the rule and how we go about permitting accesses on state highways.
I hesitate to say yes, that we would like to see that, because I don't want to slaughter any more trees than are necessary. But I think at a minimum, knowing who was at the table, and to leave it to your judgment or Mr. Greenleaf's judgment to excerpt those pieces which might be instructive, I'm not sure that we need verbatim minutes of every single convocation of the committee. But I think some of us would begin to move in a more comfortable direction about this access management fee if we had the benefit of knowing what went on. I'm certainly not saying all of us are there yet, but to the degree that you can instruct us on who was there and what the limits of the discussion were, that would be very helpful.
Chair Vakian, Senator Johnson, happy to provide that in a cursory manner.
We would appreciate that as well. And why don't you... get that through Ms. Jordan, and we'll get it to all of the committee members.
Great.
Senator Berger?
Yes. I'd like to go just a little further with that. I want to know what am I paying for? I have a piece of property, and I want access onto the state highway, and I have to send you a check for $200. I get back an application form that has a check in it and says application denied. I've paid for something. What did I pay for?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, we talked about that a little bit with, I believe, when Representative Scott was in here chairing a committee. But what I would like to do is, since it sounds like we need to get some additional information, why don't I give to you the packet that we provide to the applicants at the various levels of development, whether it be for single family resident or commercial. Also give you an example of some of the staff works have done, and also give you a copy of an example approval so you can see the type of work. And also you'll see, I think, the types of steps and the work that goes on, coordination, legal checks, the writing of the actual document, all those things that are into that, I think may be very, very helpful. And then maybe you and I can get offline and talk about that a bit more.
Acceptable, Senator Berger?
I think that's acceptable, but as I told you, and by the way, I've taken care of the other situation, so I have someone else looking at it. Jeff Scheich is going to take care of it. But I, having gone out and looked at the paperwork that was filled out, and it was just not that comprehensive, and so for that reason, I would like to know, because this is something we deal with all the time, is access management. And someone is either busy doing something, and I need to be able to say the reason you have to pay this fee is this. And another thing, and I have to tell you, I don't want to be argumentative about this, but people feel that people are hired in your department and they are paid. And so consequently, they're just doing what they're already paid to do in doing all of this paperwork. And so then you ask them to pay more. So I need some better answers.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you very much. Mr. Tindall, when you're putting together the material on the rule promulgation for the access management, I'm going to be particularly interested to know what industry segments were represented. I have had two major issues with Safeways, and if I had my way, I would welcome testimony from Mr. Oxley or any of the other Safeway representatives to know how satisfactory this fee schedule is from them, only because I have heard at length about how unhappy they are with the process.
Chair Rocky and Senator Johnson, I believe Mr. Oxley was part of at least the first group, if not both.
Good. His name was one I'm looking for.
All right.
Committee, anything further? Senator Morse.
And again, I apologize for being late, and I suspect you covered this question, but if the fee was $50 and now it's $200 up to $5,000, how are we managing the program compared to this adjustment? And you've got just a gargantuan leap in income.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, obviously if the fees are not there to support a portion of that, right now, what we're suggesting is that the benefiting properties pay 25% of the real cost of providing a service. Then, essentially, in the past, there was a lot more than 75% subsidy of those applications for private access to the state highway. So, essentially, this is recovering a bit more. But before that time, all of the work was being subsidized by the highway fund, which, of course, could have been used for other purposes.
And Senator Johnson.
I'd like, to follow on. We were looking at the budget for the transportation, I'm so used to calling it TDB, transportation planning
program. Transportation program development.
And looking at the amount of money that appears to be in that programmatic area. And just, I'm having a hard time reconciling, based on Senator Morse's question, how are we possibly handling this work previously, and then trying to reconcile that with the amount of money that appears to be sort of spread across program areas within the planning branch, and just trying to figure out the burden of absorbing this program.
Chair Vaca and Senator Johnson, it's been moved to the Highway Division budget in this budget.
Then let me ask my question in reverse. What happens if it goes back into the planning area? Because always, I mean, the access management in the worldview that I subscribe to during my time at ODOT, which admittedly was a long time and getting longer ago, access management was a creation of TDB. It lived there. All this work was done there. This was part of an innovative suite of programs that were being rolled out in the planning. It gets moved to Highway, where clearly the AG says that money cannot be used. Why not put it back into planning?
Chair Vaca and Senator Johnson, I don't believe that the AG has said that you can't use highway fund for access. In fact, I'm fairly sure that you can use highway fund for access management. It was moved into highway when we added staff out in the field, because highway has a bigger field presence. And so what we were trying to do is link up the analysis of an access with the traffic studies that go on within a region. So it wasn't a budgetary issue as to why it was moved. It was moved so we could sync it up better with where the work was actually being done.
Could you move it back to planning and sync it up where the money is?
I think a lot of money there.
Did they move the money over?
The fee revenue moves over.
It's only been in highway a year.
Yeah.
Put it back to planning.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, maybe I can just hit a couple of things there. It was moved because they're trying to make it in place with other operational issues. Planning is planning in forward sense, and highway is trying to focus on what's happening now, and we're trying to make sure that the operational permitting process that this really is goes through the highway process. So it was an organizational decision because of that. In terms of their revenue, the fees that are envisioned here would go to the highway division and be spent as part of this program.
I'm hunting for a solution that does not include fees. And I'm trying to say if the linkage between operations and access management was arbitrarily made because it had been in planning, not arbitrarily, it's a too loaded a word. You made it for reasons to sync up workload and stuff in the field. if I can then cogently make a brief for saying this is part of a planning function and you put it back into planning, what I'm trying to tease out is, then is there planning money available to do this work?
Chair Vakin, Senator Johnson, it was highway fund. At the largest level, it all goes into the highway fund. So regardless of whether it's in the planning, the TPD limitation, or in the highway division limitation, it's all coming out of the same place. The impact of not having the fees is less revenue to the highway fund, which simply means we don't do something. What that something is.
$408,000 worth of something.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair,
one more.
I think Senator Johnson is not quite done yet, so let's.
Okay.
Why don't you offer us up what some of the somethings are we wouldn't do so that we can decide if we're making an equitable trade?
Chair Vakin, Senator Johnson, I guess some of the somethings you wouldn't do are pretty well covered in what our entire budget is. I mean, it's that whole list of things that ODOT does, from building projects to. Maintaining roadways and all of the, that's all highway fund stuff. So,
last but not least, Doug, what I'm practically begging you for is some out of the box thinking about where does this go? Because I don't think there's a lot of support here for it. And I'm trying to thrust and parry back and forth with you to get to plan B. And I think we're both working at it too hard.
Okay. Representative Vakin, I'm sorry, Chair Vakin, Senator Johnson, I got the message. And we'll go back and have some discussion about how we could do it. I mean, obviously, kind of going to Senator Verger's question, there are, as Mike said, there are some of these things that we can pay for. There are some of the things we can't. And this happens to be one where we do have some options of how we would pay for it. And if you would like to set that as a policy decision, that's certainly your choice. But I'd be glad to have that discussion.
Director, you had 2 cents you want to throw in?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I think that the policy issue for this body is the level of fee that you're going to request of the private sector or property owners to receive an access management permit. If you believe that that it's there's a service we should provide at no charge to the public, that's the policy decision you can make. And essentially, we will essentially cover all of those costs within the highway fund. And so we're suggesting to you that a 25% level, and comparing it to other fees that we see from charged by cities and counties in this type of development and this type of service, is reasonable. If you don't feel that way, then tell us so, and we will go back to the $50 fee. We will still provide that service. We have a rule that says what we need to do to implement this program, and we will do it, but we will have to then do some adjustments in the budget to reflect the change that you would in not enacting those fees.
Now, Senator Westland, I'm about to head back over to Senators Morris and Verger, but you're the only one not heard from on that side of the dais. You want to get in on any of this before I keep going?
The only thing I want to say is that Senator Johnson has concerns with this package, Doug. I love it. I think.
I want to make sure that we get all the public testimony in that we need to on the next bill coming up. So maybe we'll go Senator Morris, then Senator Verger, and then unless you feel completely compelled to throw something else in, let's move on. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If it's within the scope of fund shift, the amount requested is 0.6% of the fund allocation for transportation development. Seems to me the nexus is pretty close. I'm not opposed to increasing the fees somewhat, but to come out with a $5,000 fee, and you got 19 or 20 of them, I don't know, that just seems like a really steep fee. So my request, at least for consideration, Mr. Chairman and committee members, would be to look at a fund shift from the transportation development account to the highway account in the amount that would be equal to, say, just a flat fee. If you want to raise it to $100 or $200, I haven't got real heartburn at that, but the graduated scale. And going up to that amount, that's a hard one to swallow. So,
Senator Verger.
Yes, I want to just say that, like, we're trying to do the budget based on performance standards. And you do a lot of good things, and I certainly don't want to come across that you don't, because you've known me a long time. You know what I think of your department. But in performance standards, I was just looking. You've measured, like, work zones, which that's important, and you have good scoring. You've measured Department of Motor Vehicles, time on the telephone. But the questions that come to me are from people trying to put a new building someplace or trying to access their private property. And I don't see any customer satisfaction on performance measures in those areas. And those are just tops for me, because I think you've worked out an awful lot of things on DMV, and that has fallen down sharply on the radar. So I would just like for you to think about, in terms of where we're getting, as policymakers, the pushback.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, you do not have a legislatively adopted performance measures in this area, but you certainly can, and I want to make it clear to you and the committee that we are managing a performance of access management like we never have before. We know what it takes, how long it takes for access permits to be delivered. We know that the vast majority of them are being delivered within 60 to 90 days. We know that we give approvals to about 95% of those that are requested. We have between 4% and 5% denial rates, and about half of those we actually figure out how to come to a closure. And we do have customer satisfaction ratings from a number of stakeholders. We do again a review, and we started it with the Legislative Fiscal Office. So I think if you want to make those some of your legislatively adopted performance measures, we're more than pleased to do that, because I think we have a good record, and this is a very important thing to track for the reasons you just described.
Well, I guess that I'm talking to 5%.
You are.
All I can tell you is your 5% is my 100%.
That's right.
How's that?
That's right. That's good.
On that note, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5070. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5069. And Mr. Director and Deputy Director, if you don't mind vacating the table, I think what we're going to do, and I'm sure you won't, stay in the room, though, please. We're going to have Ms. Jordan introduce the bill for us, but what we're going to do then is just take the public testimony. I want to make sure that gets in. If we have time at the end to get back to you, we will, and if not, we won't. Mr. Barrows, you will be first up if you want to make your way to the table. And Ms. Jordan?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's the budget bill for the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I'm going to reserve my remarks until we bring the agency back up to the table to talk about the policy package, and I'll introduce that.
Thank you, Mr. Barrows. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dave Barrows, here today representing BNSF Railroad, formerly known as Burlington Northern Santa Fe. And we are here to indicate our strong appreciation of the working relationship we have with the rail division of ODOT. Mrs. Taylor, the new manager, is an excellent communicator, coordinator. We work well with her. We're off to a great start. We feel kind of a new energy and a new focus of that division, and we just wanted to indicate to the subcommittee our strong support of that division of the department, because it's so important to us, and we just love working with them, and they do a terrific job. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Committee? No? Thank you, Mr. Barrows.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Lisa Wright?
Mr. Barrows, are you speaking about Kelly Taylor? Kelly Taylor used to be with DMV?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, I'm not sure she was with DMV. I believe she was in the director's office, but she used to represent DMV here. That's correct. That would be the one.
That Kelly Taylor.
Yes.
Hey, we're all entitled to our own opinion.
And I'm always delighted, Senator, when mine's correct.
I share
Senator Westland?
Conviction.
Okay. Lisa Wright?
Excuse me, I'm a little nervous this afternoon.
Right, all right, take your time.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Wright, and I'm here to represent Crossroads, Inc. We're located here in Salem, Oregon. Crossroads is a private family-owned small business in which we provide support services to the transportation industry. We assist in licensing, fuel and mileage tax reporting, and compliance issues for trucking companies. So we work on a daily basis with the Motor Carrier Division of the Oregon Department of Transportation. And I am here today in support of them. And I think that as a politics major, I'm currently studying the state and governmental policies of the state of Oregon. I know that all of you end up probably hearing more complaints from your constituents than you actually do compliments. So I'm here today to let you know that the Motor Carrier Division of the Oregon Department of Transportation is an excellent state agency. Our clientele represent trucking companies of all sizes, from the owner-operator all the way up to large fleets. We work with companies that are based nationwide and also in Canada. So I deal with Oregon, but I deal with a whole lot of other state regulatory agencies. There is a level of professionalism that is displayed by the Motor Carrier Division that is par none. I can't think of another state that I work with that is anywhere near what they display. They have taken great strides in the last 2 years of automating a lot of their systems, which has helped our business tremendously. You can access forms, you can file taxes over the internet, as well as obtaining certain permits, like weight mileage permits, that carriers would need in order to operate through the state of Oregon. Not very many other states have this type of comprehensive services. One of the things that I noted with working over the internet is how easy it is to work with them, and also that in previous years, when you would call in and you would need to speak with the Motor Carrier Division, sometimes you would wait 20 minutes to speak to an analyst. That doesn't happen anymore, and I strongly attribute that to the strides that they have taken to provide so many services over the internet. Because it's so easy to use it, it also makes it very, very easy on a lot of our clients that are farmers or small enterprises, because they can obtain these permits 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And so when they may not be able to get an analyst, they can do it all on their own. And I say that a little tongue-in-cheek, because basically, if it gets any easier, I might not have a job. So... But it is wonderful, and one of the things that I want to...
Did you notice, committee, as a student of political science, she has nothing but good things to say about anybody, and now she wants a job. I think that's pretty good. I think she's off to a good start.
One of the things that I did want to... I just wanted to spend 1 minute or one slight area and just letting you know that there have been a few issues... in the past with other states where, for instance, in January, we had a carrier who was based in the state of California whom was given, because of their state budget cuts, what ended up happening is that their renewals and their credentials could not be issued on time. Their current tags were expired, and they received, within a one-day period across the United States, $2,700 in fines, which, if you know anything about... licensing, usually that's more than 1 year's tags on a truck. We've never had any issues like this with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Things are done on time. They're done in a professional manner. Finally, the staff at the Motor Carrier Division, they're well-trained. They're knowledgeable. When there's something that I don't know and I need some expertise in that area, I can call them, and they're always very courteous and very helpful. This doesn't happen at a lot of other state agencies either. I've stated before in associations and other presentations, and also to my own clients whom, believe me, I hear a lot about how bad state agencies can be. I'm always one of the first to state that the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Motor Carrier Division should be used in a model, in my opinion, for other states to maybe even take training from. I mean, I'm not sure how that would work, but they could be used as a model. In my line of business, the professionalism exhibited by this division is an attribute that is rarely displayed. So I guess that's it. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to be able to testify and to share with you what a positive experience it is to work with these people. And if you have any questions.
Senator Johnson.
Perhaps Mr. Del Ponte would accompany ask you to accompany him to his next performance review with the director. Following both witnesses, I'm just sorry that Ms. Taylor and Mr. Del Ponte weren't in the room to hear the kind of accolades that folks that they deal with are receiving in front of the director. Thank you for your testimony.
Senator Westland.
And with the quality of your testimony, I'm sure Mr. Del Ponte would be happy to have you there. You did very well.
Thank you.
You did. You hide your nerves well. Thank you, Ms. Wright.
Thank you.
Roger Martin.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I'm here representing two organizations. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Transit Association, and I'm the contract lobbyist for the Union Pacific Railroad, and I would like to continue this train of praises for the agency. But I want to start by saying this is my...
In order, Mr. Martin.
This is my 20th session in this building, dating back to the mid-1960s. And I have observed closely the Department of Transportation because I served on committees that dealt with transportation, and at that time it was the Highway Commission. And I just want to say in front of all the people that are behind me, you've got the best agency that this agency's ever had in 40 years. They are responsive, they are highly professional, and I find them as cooperative as any time in the past. And it started, my era started with when... the agency was run by somewhat of a czar from Southern Oregon, and its highway engineer was named Forrest Cooper, who would make General Schwarzkopf look like a mild-mannered Clark Kent. They did it exactly the way they wanted to, and they occasionally discussed things with the legislature. You would have never had the exchange you just had in the last hour with that agency at that time. They wouldn't even appear before the Ways and Means Committee. They would have just sent a message over. Here's what our budget's going to be.
Send the money.
I really mean it. I think that ODOT is as good as it's been ever. I want to speak specifically to the Transit Division. The Oregon Transit Association is made up of about four dozen public transportation providers that range from a large one like TriMet down to some very small nonprofit that are transporters of the senior and disabled. We work very closely with Martin Loring and the Transit Division. We don't always agree on everything, but we're able to work it out and rarely ever come to the legislature with any disagreement. We find them thoughtful and cooperative. We jointly sponsor a transportation seminar every fall in Seaside, Oregon. Some of you have had an opportunity to attend. We work very closely with them to make sure that the smaller systems have the opportunity to learn something, and that's what our association's about. There's very little we can teach TriMet. But there's a lot we need to help the smaller system with who just don't have, usually have very new personnel that don't have the background. And he's been very cooperative. The rail division, Dave Barrow said it, and I want to emphasize that. Kelly Taylor has been in this office for just a little over a year. And she's a dream. And let me just express that the Union Pacific Railroad had no lobbyists until about a year ago, and they did not know most of what went on in the state of Oregon. Their experience in other states with transportation departments has not been wonderful. In fact, my counterpart in the state of Idaho refers to the Idaho Department of Transportation to the in the presence of the director, Bruce Warner's counterpart, as the Idaho Department of Trucks, because they could care less that the railroad runs through the state, and they don't make any intent to do anything with rail division. When they found out and first got introduced to Oregon's rail division and to Kelly, they were very heartened. They're going to spend more money on their system in Oregon than they planned to, because it's a cooperation effort. Much of the rail system in Oregon is either been owned by the Union Pacific for over 100 years, or it was acquired when they acquired the Southern Pacific Railroad in the mid-1990s. Some of that rail bed is, much of it is now leased to the short-haul carriers. And the rail, much of that rail is older than I am, and that makes it very old. The ties, much of the ties need to be replaced. The company itself leases it to most of these companies for $1 a year, with the understanding that the freight that originates on those short lines ends up on our main line. But I observed Kelly doing something that I thought was as good as you can do. About 3 weeks ago, one of the short lines opened a tunnel through the mountains into California that had burned 2 years ago. They spent about $18 million. The Union Pacific made part of that contribution to rebuild that tunnel. And we were on a train supplied by the Union Pacific, a rail passenger train, for about an hour or 2 hours. And Kelly ended up sitting with the short line CEO from Florida, and very adroitly brought to his attention that much of the line to Coos Bay as an example, is in real need of upgrading. And she pointed out that her department is in charge of rail safety. And she very, very nicely, without being offensive at anyone, brought to his attention that more has to be invested on that line in order to move freight at any kind of speed and to be able to move the cars that are heavier today. And I point that out only because many agency people would be a little dictatorial about it. She wasn't at all, but she got her point across, and they're going to react to it. So I hope you don't mind me continuing the praise, but we are very happy about our dealings with the Department of Transportation, the Rail Division, and the Transit Division.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. Roger, do you have an opinion on the fee proposed for rail fixed guideway safety oversight?
This is where he starts to rail on them rather than carry the freight.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, that really doesn't. That's TriMet, and I'd have to ask TriMet to comment. They're the largest one. I don't think they have a problem with it, but I'll find that out. I don't represent the other excursion railroads that are involved in it. I don't know that it's a major problem for them, but I'll find out from TriMet if they have any problem with it.
Kelly Taylor?
Same one that lobbied for the agency.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank you very much.
Burton Least?
Mr. Chairman, Art Schlack, join me?
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Burton Wiest. I signed up on behalf of Special Districts, and Art and I are here to talk about the TGM program. I just want to take 2 seconds, if I may, indulge the committee. One of my other hats is I'm the project manager for the U.S. Borax Project in Brookings, and that's 1,000 housing units, a community college site, and a commercial area that has only access to Highway 101. We just had our master plan approved last fall, and I am dealing with ODOT on a very daily basis, practically, on access issues. And I have actually signed a check for a fee. And I just want to say that my experience with ODOT on the access issues has been excellent. We have had quarterly meetings with ODOT staff coming all the way from Roseburg in many cases to come down and meet with us to coordinate all the three entrances on 101, coordinate all the traffic issues. We think we have, I can remember some fairly significant checks on this, and we think it's been a bargain. Now, this is a project, obviously, of a large size, which, you know, is not the same as a private individual property owner trying to get access. But I want to tell you, our experience has been excellent in working with ODOT, and we have not had any negative issues with them whatsoever. We've even coordinated with them the paving of 101 in our project, so we don't have to go dig up new paving to put our water and sewer lines, which I think is a novel approach to public works. And so we've been able to coordinate that and coordinate all the access issues. So I just, if I may, Mr. Chair, say that for the record. If I may return to why I'm here, actually. I am here on behalf of Special Districts, and I am the current chair of the Transportation Growth Management Advisory Committee. Arch Lack, to my right, represents counties on that advisory committee. The committee was established 10 years ago by a budget note of Ways and Means, which required the users of the Transportation and Growth Management Program to have an advisory committee to deal with the program, and we, Art and I, have been on that committee since its inception. The TGM program is a unique partnership between LCDC, the Department of Transportation, and local governments, cities, counties, and special districts. And each biennium, this program, in the last biennium, this program distributed about $6 million in grants to local governments to assist in planning projects. And the purpose of the program is to ensure that the planning is coordinated between transportation issues, planning issues, and the ability of local governments to fund their share of these projects to make sure that it all fits together and works. And we're very proud of the job that not only the advisory committee has done for the last 10 years, but we're very proud of the program and what it has managed to accomplish. And so we're here to commend that to you. I know you don't have the actual budget and all the numbers and things in front of you at this time, but we just wanted to, on behalf of the advisory committee, commend to you the TGM program. And with that, I'll shut up.
Mr. Chair, just clarification. Could you tell me where your housing project is?
It is approximately 2 miles north of downtown Brookings on Highway 101. It's within the city of Brookings. It was annexed about a year ago.
Is it connected to Southwestern?
Yes. And what the Borax has done is they have donated 10 acres of land to the Southwestern Oregon Community College for a building site. You, in the last two sessions, allocated money.
Right.
And so there's approximately $2 million available. The community college went in went in Brookings and searched for 5 years trying to find land, and the cheapest five-acre plot they could find was $6 million. So they talked to Borax, and Borax donated 10 acres, and with the $2 million, they'll be able to build the campus as soon as we and ODOT and the city of Brookings get the road improvements and the sewer and water to the property, which hopefully will be by next spring.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Mr. Weiss. No, Mr. Slack?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Here to briefly lend our support for the continued funding of the Transportation Growth Management Program within ODOT and LCDC. As you recall, that program uses primarily federal funds, but it also does have at least some components of general fund within those programs. The grants to local governments are especially needed and continue to be needed, as this program provides the link between land use and transportation. This is one of the few places where we really bring land use planning and transportation planning together in transportation system plans. And those plans look beyond just a jurisdiction's boundaries. For instance, a county's transportation plan takes into consideration the state system, coordinates with the city systems and the county systems. So if you take a look at the county's transportation system plan, it is an integration of all those systems that hopefully work together. There is, needless to say, continued need. These plans have been developed over a period of time. They continue to need to be refined and to meet the new expectations as a result of changes in administrative rules at LCDC, and also the plans and policies of the Oregon Transportation Commission. And to give you an example, the Transportation Commission is placing new emphasis on planning regarding interchanges. And as a result of that, they are looking at interchange management system plans around the state. And this will require a new level of additional coordination between the land use planning, transportation planning of cities and counties, and the state of Oregon at this point. So this is just one example of of the changes that we're seeing, and I would say one of the reasons why this program is so badly needed, and we support its continuation and would ask for your support of the program in the budgetary process.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Carter.
As I have listened to all of you come and talk about ODOT, Board of Medical Examiners and DHS, they are never, ever without critics, because you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. So it's really nice after 20 years to sit here and hear this budget and hear all of the cooperation that is going on between interested groups and the Department of Transportation. So I think it's a two-way street, and that for all of you guys to work so cooperatively certainly makes me feel good as a legislator who's been on this committee for all these 20 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Kelly Brooks. Kelly Brooks from the City of Eugene, not here anymore. All right, but is there anybody else in the room who wants to testify regarding... Yes.
Yes.
Jessica, come on up. Have a seat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
Of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We work very closely with the Highway Division of ODOT, and given that the Transit and the Rail Divisions have received so many compliments, it wouldn't be fair to ignore the division that carries a great deal of responsibility for delivering your roads and bridges and your construction program. AGC and ODOT have a tremendous relationship. In fact, I would say that out of all the agencies that we work with, ODOT is perhaps the agency with whom we have the best relationship with. We meet on a very frequent basis with ODOT. Our contractors and their technical staff, people like Jeff Gower and Kathy Nelson and Tom Lauer, meet on a monthly basis, and we work cooperatively on issues that ODOT has with contractors and contractors have with ODOT, and reach an agreement in a way that is so cooperative and so helpful and so important to our industry. When we're out there building multi-million-dollar projects and you have conflicts and there's confusion and issues that arise, it is very helpful for the industry to be able to approach ODOT and work on a comprehensive solution to those issues. When the time comes to revise specifications, we're informed first. It's not something that gets shoved down our throat, but something that we work together to make sure that those changes are to the benefit of the public and ensure a safe, effective, and judicious institution of new specifications. So we very much appreciate the work that the head of the Highway Division, Doug Tindall, Bruce Warner, and all of their supportive staff underneath, their engineers, their project managers, do to make these projects move forward and make working with them a positive experience. Not that we don't, you know, there aren't conflicts within the family, but it is a very, very positive agency with whom we're very grateful for the good relationship with.
Hmm. Senator Westland.
Do you know Kelly Taylor?
Senator Westland, yes, I do, and she's wonderful.
Oh, no further questions.
It's unanimous, then. Thank you. You may now run. And Deputy Director, if you don't mind coming back up to the table. I think what we'll do, since we don't have much time remaining, is go to Policy Package 474, which is the one related to your headquarters building. And if you don't mind just giving us a brief summary just to get this started on the record, don't feel the need to run us right till 3 o'clock. And committee, if you don't, I'm most interested in just allowing the agency to get this on the record and get us started with this policy package. So unless you don't have, if you don't have questions, let's end a little early because we're all going to be back at 3:30 for another hearing.
Mr. Chair, Mike Marsh, the Department of Transportation. Thank you. I can take a hint.
Thank you.
I'll just briefly go through, and I think your LFO staff is sending out a handout that relates to the transportation building. We have a lot of other financial information that we're working with Legislative Fiscal Office on, but this is to mainly just give some perspective, I think, within the short time that we have about the ODOT building. As many of the members are aware, buildings on the Capitol Mall have been renovated over the last 15 years. Most of the buildings were built on the mall between 1929 and 1952. This building was built in 1950, and it's the last one to be renovated. It has problems with lead-based paint, asbestos, seismic issues. The systems are inefficient. It's the only building, when you look out on the Capitol Mall, you'll see all the 220 air conditioners hanging on the outside of it instead of finding that it has some kind of a ventilation system like all the other buildings do. A lot of challenge in terms of the inefficient use of space. It's broken up into a lot of different offices inside instead of being an open office landscape like the other buildings on the Capitol Mall. We're pointing out concerns of potential risk. I'm not trying to say that employees are jeopardized by what goes on within the building in terms of fungus and other things that exist in some buildings of older systems, but we do have concerns there and want to make sure that those are addressed like they have been in the other buildings. It also relates to power supply issues and concerns as we get more computers into the building. It becomes a concern about how we're going to fit the building up for that kind of major power use. And you get to a point where you have to either put major investment into, like I mentioned earlier, that 1967 Dodge Dart, or whether you're going to suck it up and decide you'll make another investment and replace that vehicle. What we want to do is to make sure that we do get that renovation done on the vehicle of the Department of Transportation building and to ensure that we've dealt with renovation of the building, not that we want to construct any new facilities, just to get that building done.
Ms. Marsh, if you hang on just a second, Senator Johnson.
No, I'm happy to have him finish. I just wanted to get in the queue.
Oh.
I'll continue if that's okay then. We want to get that work done and to get it completed. The recommendation coming forward to you as the method of doing so is to do it in partnership with the Department of Transport, with the Department of Administrative Services. What we've got is a recognition that maybe the best way to move it forward would be to have the work done with them acquiring the building and becoming one of the standard buildings on the Capitol Mall. If the members look to the third and fourth page of the handout, just to give a little perspective, I was mentioning the air conditioners hanging on the building. The types of floor construction and corridors that exist in that building mean that about 8 to 9% of the building are corridor space. In an efficiently laid out building, there'll be a much smaller amount of space in corridors and a lot more productively used by employees. Also, in other pictures, you can see examples of the kinds of concern in old construction where you have the piping and other elements of the building infrastructure which are not accessible, which makes it a lot less efficiently done to in order to get work completed on the building. We also have a lot of records in the structure, critical records that relate to bridges and other infrastructure in the state of Oregon, which are not in the greatest storage situation. And we either need to renovate and deal with major investment in trying to get that appropriately housed or to do small increments of improvement which don't really get to where it needs to be to protect those records. So as I'm saying, that if we go to page 6 of the discussion, it talks about the Department of Transportation and Administrative Services partnership here. We went to the Capital Projects Advisory Board to discuss this plan about a year ago and got approval to move it forward in the governor's recommended budget. We want to make sure the project is completed. The recommendation of the governor is to have us sell it to DAS. And then that we would be within the uniform rent program and occupy the building as our other agencies on the Capitol Mall. We understand options include us completing the building under our own ownership and are working with Legislative Fiscal Office to ensure that there's full information about that alternative. But want to make sure that, there's a recognition that by us selling it, then moving back in our headquarters components of ODOT, leaving the technical components of the department outside of the downtown and Capitol Mall area, could allow for another state agency to move into the remaining space within the building and meet the statutory need to have headquarters functions of agencies on the Capitol Mall. So that's the reason why we thought it would make some sense in terms of the corporation to have us sell the building to DAS, and then we would go into lease space and at some point in the future maybe have a building built on Airport Road. However, if there's concern about that plan, we are certainly open to retaining ownership and working with Department of Administrative Services about how that would happen also. So, Mr. Chair, what we're trying to do is make sure a project moves forward. As we say, the last building on the Capitol Mall to get this kind of renovation to allow for productive space, eliminate risks both to employees and to the public who use the building, and to make sure we're prepared for potential seismic events that may come in the future, and have a workplace that's efficient in doing the things you'd like to see done. I'm open to questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
You've already touched on the mic a little bit, but I'm going to ask you to amplify if you wouldn't mind. There are little pockets of ODOT scattered all over the place, and I think that you made the point that headquarters of of agencies be on the mall versus trying to consolidate all of ODOT in one place so that you didn't send customers out hunting for the little bits and pieces that are scattered around. Have you given any thought to, instead of renting out space in a newly renovated building, to consolidating all of ODOT operations in one place?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, yes. We would like to be able to do that, and if it was the interest of the legislature as a policy decision to allow us to renovate the building within our own funds and get the productivity there of probably 20% more folks into the building under a new renovated building and move a few out of leased space, we would certainly be willing to do that. The challenge in doing it with totally within our own budget is that we know there are other needs for highway fund. And if the decision of the legislature is to say that this is important enough to go ahead and use ODOT funds, highway fund, to get the project complete, we'd certainly salute and move forward. I don't mean to speak for the governor, but I'm saying that that's the fallback position. The concern is that by doing it through Department of Administrative Services, they have the large buildings on the mall. They can get other agencies to come in and get use of it. Maybe we can benefit a general fund agencies in addition to ourselves.
Thank you. My question was less focused on the funding mechanism than it was on the Mill Creek building, for example. That building has manifold deficiencies. I was just trying to figure out how much money you save by getting out of what I used to believe was a pretty pricey lease to move them back into an ODOT headquarters building.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, briefly, the plan that how we have brought forward as the governor's recommendation would have us taking those functions that are headquarters functions, like transportation development and rail and transit, out of that building and put them into the transportation building. Right. And so it would address, I think, that immediate concern.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else, committee? Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You referenced the governor's proposal, which this policy package represents, and I recognize my question is not a fair one.
Okay, so as opposed to all the others that were asked here today.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
But in your judgment, from an operational standpoint, as a department, which is the preferred alternative for you to own the building, renovate it, and fill it up essentially with ODOT staff, or to move forward with the proposal we have on the table? And I offer this question from the perspective of, Mike, you mentioned we need to keep dollars going to highway construction. I agree. However, if it's financed, if the building's financed, you don't have any trade because you're going to pay for it out of rent assessments anyway, just over time. So you could continue to own the building, consolidate your own operations, and finance it, and have the same net effect as you would if you transferred it to DAS and went through those hoops. So my question is, from an operational standpoint, what would be your recommendation?
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, I'll start and see what I do here, and if I'm still at the table, then, well, no, I did okay. The bottom line for us, Mr. Chair, is there's a need to renovate the building. And when it starts getting in comparison with other highway projects, that's what the senator is indicating a concern about. It can be financed over time, and we could do it ourselves. I think the bottom line is we want to make sure the project's complete. And working with DAS, we thought there would be benefits that the legislature might see in having a corporate look at this rather than just ODOT going at it alone. I think it's a policy decision that's perfectly appropriate that we can support either way, whether the decision is to have DAS own it or us own it, we can work with it. So the bottom line for us is to make sure that the renovation gets done, that employees and the public get protected in what we have there, and it's an efficient building. How it gets done, we have some cost information for Susie that shows that it's pretty darn close in terms of the 40-year life of the building, which way we go. There would be a little bit of cost impact to the positive for the state highway fund, possibly, if we do it ourselves. But when you account for the challenge of making sure that does get funded within the highway fund, and also the fact that on the other side, you help potentially general fund or other fund agencies, the corporate element of the decision makes it a little bit more just a toss-up between the two.
I'll remind the committee, too, we'll have plenty of time with them on this building in the future. But we've got 2 minutes left if anybody would like to jump in again. So.
Kelly Taylor get a new office out of that.
There we go.
Mr. Director, final words.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess I first off would like to thank you for your time and effort. And again, I did actually enjoy the conversation about access management as much as it seemed painful at times. I think we've done some great things in that program. I welcome some further dialogue with you. And clearly, I look forward to a further discussion with you on the fees, and we will come back with some recommendations that if you don't want to increase those fees, what we can do and to essentially make up those dollars and where it would come from. And I've heard some pretty clear suggestions from the committee. So I've enjoyed working with you, and I hope you found it helpful also. It was a lot of information in a very short amount of time, but again, the time is very much appreciated, and it sounds like maybe I should have done some more time one-on-one with access management, since I knew that's always an issue. So again, I apologize for that.
Not necessary. Thank you, Mr. Director and Deputy Director, and Ms. Shearer as well. I must say, too, it's been a pleasure chairing the apparent Senate Subcommittee on Transportation today. and we'll just remind the committee that we're back at 3:30 for a public hearing on 5064. And with that, we're close the public hearing.
One quick, I want to underscore something Senator Carter said a little earlier, and I've only been here half as long as she has, and I think someone sitting between the chair and Margaret Carter would agree with this. But I can't tell you how refreshing it is for you guys to come in here, your forthright answers and your attitudes, and the support that's being voiced by your customers, all our customers. It is a dramatic change. When the audit committee was doing the audit where we had to employ an outside auditor to look over Secretary of State's audit division. I mean, some of you guys remember that. Just thank you.
Bruce Warner is the only executive that we have not talked about firing in committee.
I will very quickly gavel out the public hearing on 5069.
That's not true, Mark.
And adjourn us till... I'm opening up a hearing on House Bill 5026 regarding the Oregon Racing Commission, a public hearing, and we will we have Ms. Hansen here, the director of the Racing Commission, Ms. Shearer from the Budget Management Division. Mr. Siebert, why don't you give us an introduction to the bill, and then Ms. Hansen, will go to you.
Mr. Chair, I'm Paul Siebert, Senator Fiscal, with the assigned to the Racing Commission budget. I want to go through a handout that provided your offices last week, a little bit about the agency, since this is the first time they're up in front of the subcommittee. This commission is a completely other funds funded budget and commission, but they're kind of unique because of the revenues that they receive, and they receive revenues from the state share of wagering receipts, license fees, and license fines. The revenues are first used for commission expenses, and then remaining funds are transferred to the general fund. And in the past few biennia, particularly with the introduction of the wagering hubs in Oregon, this entity is a general fund generating commission for the state. So they actually make you money. I just want to go through a few budget issues. First of all is the end of the greyhound racing in Oregon at Multnomah Greyhound Park. This decision was made in December of last year and was not made in time for the governor's recommended budget to reflect the changes to the commission's budget. I've been working with the commission to put together a package that will significantly reduce expenditures because of the end of the regulation for greyhound racing. at least in the foreseeable future, if by chance the Greyhound were to start racing again in some other location, the commission would have the ability to come to the emergency board and seek some position authority. But you'll be seeing a package in front of you that will reduce expenditures and revenues because of the end of that racing. Also wanted to mention briefly that the commission is considering an administrative rule that would cap the amount of tax that hubs collect on behalf of the state. Currently, the tax is set at 0.25% of all the handle or the amount wagers through these hubs, and these are operations within the state that take bets on simulcast racing from all over the country, and if I'm not mistaken, even in overseas. So the commission is considering a rule that would cap the amount of tax that these entities pay. There are six currently operating in Oregon that would cap it at $300,000 a year. And currently that's projected, based on the way the rule is written now, to create a reduction of about $750,000 currently, and in statute, the way that tax is handled is one-third of the money goes to the general fund, and two-thirds of those monies go into the racing development fund for the benefit of the racing industry in Oregon. So the commission is concerned with a number of other states looking at attracting these wagering hubs to relocate to their state. So in order to retain the hubs and make sure that they stay in Oregon, the commission is considering this rule. One reason you have yet to see this agency is because of issues like the decision on the administrative rule to cap the taxes, and also the effect of the Greyhound racing. I believe the commission will be deciding on that rule at their next meeting, which, if I'm not mistaken, is next week.
That's correct. It's the 20th.
Finally, I wanted to just point out that there is still some uncertainty about the horse racing continuing at Portland Meadows. In statute, the Portland Meadows is not allowed to do simulcast wagering if there's not live racing going on. And I believe there's a bill that's passed the Senate, and if I'm not mistaken, was voted on by the House. Either has been recently voted on or will be soon voted on by the House, and that's Senate Bill 929 that would allow the continuation of the simulcast racing. There was just one budget note that was included in the Commission's budget, directing them to keep LFO and Budget and Management informed on their expenditures and revenues. The Commission made one appearance before the Emergency Board to request expenditure limitation for monies from the Racing Development Fund. As I discussed earlier, two-thirds of the tax from the hubs go into the Racing Development Fund. The revenue going into that fund was higher than we had anticipated in the legislatively adopted budget last biennium, so the commission sought and was given authority to increase their expenditure limitation by $900,000. And that's all I have for you today. Mr. Chair, I believe that Jody Hansen from the Racing Commission is here to talk about first the commission's performance measures, and then Christina Shearer from Budget Management is here to go over the governor's recommended budget, and Jody will continue then on with her presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Sievert. And actually, go ahead and give your name for the record and your title and such. I'd like to ask you something before you launch into your presentation.
Okay. Mr. Chair, my name is Jody Hansen, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Racing Commission.
Mr. Sievert mentioned the demise of Greyhound racing at Multnomah Greyhound Park. I'm just curious, are there efforts underway right now by any groups to start up the park on another location?
Mr. Chair, kind of what's going on with that, with Senate Bill 929, there was a kind of a fear that Greyhound racing would be abolished completely. That hasn't happened, fortunately, and there's been a number of inquiries to the Commission office regarding the possibility of starting up another Greyhound racing track at some point. I don't imagine it would be for at least a year, but there is a really huge interest, and there are really a number of high-quality Greyhounds in Oregon that could race. So,
is there
Is there a particular organization or group? Is there an organized effort, or are you just getting ad hoc phone calls about it?
Mr. Chair, the Oregon Greyhound Association that is currently running the adoption kennel has been highly involved with talking with a number of various groups, and I know that they have talked to the City of Portland as well. They have contacted some outside companies. They have... I have referred everyone that's called me to Mr. Dick Gage, who is the executive director of the Oregon Greyhound Association. So, grassroots at this point, I would say, but I believe it will fire up.
Senator Johnson.
Just to ask a clarifying point, I think what the chair is asking about is the viability of the renewal of Greyhound racing. What I hear you answering is the Greyhound adoption folks are now the conduit for the information. And it was my belief that those folks don't like greyhound racing, so I got a disconnect here. I need help with.
Maybe they go out of business if all the greyhounds.
Yeah, no greyhounds, so. No adoptions.
Keep racing.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, and that's a very good question, and I can clarify that. The Oregon Greyhound Association is actively involved with the racing dogs, and not only do they run the adoption kennel, but they're the ones that actually run the purse structure for the race meet. They're responsible for all the dogs. They're a big player in the actual race meet itself. So they're the four greyhound folks. But not the anti-greyhound folks.
Thank you. That was helpful.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and start with your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The Oregon Racing Commission currently has four performance measures that were developed for the 2003-2005 biennium. Three of them were new and were developed through the appropriate processes. The four performance measures provide the Oregon Racing Commission with information which is used to manage and evaluate our agency performance, along with a number of other goals that we have. The information from the performance measures is assisting us in tracking trends in the parimutuel industry, such as the decline in the live handle, which is the total amount wagered, and increases in technological forms of wagering, such as simulcasting or broadcasting the signal or the hub account wagering. As far as the four performance measures themselves go, the first one is the number of horses destroyed per 1,000 starters. And these performance measures may sound very odd to you, but they do provide a purpose, I'll try to explain it a little bit. The performance measure is less than 1.5 horses destroyed per 1,000 starters. And that's a goal that we've set, and although there's a number of factors that come into play, such as the track itself, the condition of the horses, I mean, are they sick? There's a number of things that come into play as far as whether or not they have to be destroyed, but our veterinarian does a really good job in looking at the horses before they race and trying to assess which horses may not look sound enough to race. So currently, we are have met this performance measure. We have been at 1.5 as of this last year. The second performance measure is the number of disciplinary rulings issued per 1,000 races. The horse stewards and the dog judges who oversee both of those race meets individually have hearings and issue rulings on potential violations or violations. The goal for 2004 was 52, 60 were issued. And so we have exceeded that performance measure. And how I look at this is in racing, there is kind of a good old boys club. And what we're trying to do is provide fair and consistent regulation for everybody. And if I see these numbers starting to go down, and although we have a collaborative relationship with the industry that we regulate, I still wonder, you know, how much voluntary compliance you're going to get. You can only get so much. So if this number starts to go down drastically, then I start to wonder if people are actually doing their job. So then I get out there and start looking at and start going to the hearings myself.
Well, and for our benefit, how are we to gauge whether this means they're not doing their job or you lack resources to get the job done or you're doing your job very well and that's the reason for the decrease? How does this committee know?
Well, that's a very good question, Mr. Chair, and that's a concern that I have about this performance measure that will be looked at by the commission due to the number of factors with the closure of the Graham Park and some of the new licensing of hubs and some rule changes that we've had. The performance measures weren't looked at as thoroughly as we would have liked for this upcoming biennium. And I can assure you that it's on our list. There's been some strategic planning that's taken place with the commission, and we are going to be looking at them. And
what we have before us now, are you telling us it's invalid and we should just ignore it? Or can you give us some direction on how to take what you've given us?
Well, I can give you an example of the validity of it. And it's been fairly consistent for the last several years. This year, the 2005, which will be added shortly to this chart, our rulings dropped. And there was a change in the presiding steward out at the horse track. The deputy steward was given the opportunity to act as the presiding steward, basically as a test, because our presiding steward is 76 years old and will be not with us probably after a few more years. And this person didn't perform a fair, consistent regulatory practices, and the number went drastically down because he was just letting people off, saying, don't do it again. And so I went out there and started interviewing people and talking about that, and he is no longer with the agency. So that example, I think, at least should give you some confidence that this data is showing that we have resources and that we are accomplishing our job.
Go ahead, Senator Thompson.
No, I was looking at signals coming in from the door, and you mistook them as questions.
Oh, sorry. Thank you for that. Go ahead. To the next performance measure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The third performance measure, again, sounds confusing to somebody who's not familiar with the racing industry, and it is the total dollar amount of simulcast handle compared to $1,000 of live track handle. The performance measures, the performance measure for 2004 was the 4,800. We came in at 4,946, and basically this is the live handle divided by the simulcast handle. And the purpose of this is to provide a regulatory, the whole purpose for the agency is to look at this performance measure and see that simulcasting is enhancing live racing at commercial racetracks. By the simulcast number going up, which is the trend as far as technology goes, it does show that it is enhancing live horse racing. This is another performance measure that the agency would like to take a look at to see if we can't find something a little bit more that the public could look at and you could look at that makes a bit more sense.
I think we're maybe one for three on performance measures. We can.
Yes.
All right.
And I'm just being, Mr. Chair, I'm just being very open about it.
Well, we appreciate that. Get on to the fourth one.
Number four is the total purse supplements at the summer fair meets to the total industry disbursements from this development fund that the commission has. And this measure actually the purse supplements from the development fund, the computerized HUD funds that we have licensed bring in an extensive amount of income. There'll be about $1 million of it that's going into the general fund from the last biennium, and about $2 million of it that goes into this racing development fund, which started in about 2000 in order to help these five summer families out in rural Oregon prosper and survive. Because the fair meets are an event in these small towns in rural Oregon. They provide jobs. They do a lot for the agricultural businesses out in rural Oregon. So what this Racing Development Fund does is it gives purse money or prize money to the summer fairs in order to draw horses and riders to those summer fair meets and participate, and it's been really successful. What this shows is the performance measure is 3.5 in 2000. We came in at 3. And what this means is that due to the changes in the industry and how this fund has been growing so large, up to $2 million for the biennium for the racing industry, is that money is now being shifted over into the commercial race meets, which is also Portland Meadows was given $183,000 last year to supplement their purses because a need for that level of funding. So what the commission is doing now, they have this rule that's going to be heard next Thursday at the commission meeting regarding the taxation. Also, they during their strategic planning sessions and
taxation of what?
Oh, taxation of the HUD revenue, Senator Johnson and Mr. Chair.
I covered that and I wasn't here. Don't do it again. Don't. Sorry.
Why don't you go ahead and give us a brief?
No, that isn't fair. Don't do it. I'll get caught up.
Mr. Chair, maybe I can just...
I think it's all right because I don't think it was really covered before. So if we can just do it really briefly, though, that would be
fine. Mr. Speaker.
The multi-jurisdictional hubs were started in 1997 in Oregon, and what they are is they are, in essence, computer hub centers that take bets from all over the country.
Right.
And the two-thirds of that money, the tax, we tax it at 0.25%, the state gets. They're allowed by statute to tax up to 1%. The commission has set in rule the tax at 0.25%. Two-thirds of that money goes into this racing development fund. Historically, the state in past biennia provided general fund to summer race meets to supplement purses. So not only has the hub revenue, the other third goes in the general fund, I'm sorry. Not only have these hubs generated general fund monies, they've also reduced the burden on the general fund because the state no longer provides these supplements for summer race meets. What the commission is considering is an administrative rule that would cap the amount of taxes that each hub pays, total taxes, at $300,000 a year starting out and then gradually increasing over time. We're projecting that would mean about a $750,000 reduction in taxes and hub tax for the 05-07 biennium, probably closer to $700,000 for the 05-07 biennium. And I don't know if am I getting to what you're asking?
Yeah, no, you are.
Okay.
As long as we've had this break, can I go back and ask one other question about the transfers to the state fairs? I mean, to the county fairs. I'm trying to understand whether or not, with the activities of the Racing Commission, we're trying to build an industry or supplement the general fund or do both. And I think it's a little of do both, but I'm trying to get to the idea of you're building this development fund, and is there any way to track fair to fair how many riders there were? And I'm making these numbers up. You give them $100,000 in 2005 to supplement purses, and 50 people show up to race. You give them $200,000 the next year, and 300 people come to race. Is there any way that you're tracking the augmentation of the purses with participation, or is it the same old gang that are just getting bigger purses?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, you're very right in that it is a dual purpose to build the industry and to supplement the general fund. And the commission does track all of the money that goes out, that is given out through the industry for the development fund. And the money is actually given out for races by the number of races. The supplement has been the same for the last few years. It's $2,000 a race. And there have been an increase in the number of races at a few of the race meets. This year,
can I draw the conclusion that it's more horses running in more races? It's not the same horses running in more races?
Absolutely, okay. Senator Johnson.
Does that then lead, you do the cap, we lose $700,000 in a biennium. On the premise, I suppose, then, because of that increased volume of animals that are running, that you end up making that up later. Is that right, or you do the cap and we just lose the money?
Mr. Chair, that you do the cap and the revenue stream changes, it will decline. The whole purpose of the commission looking at the taxation issue was because of the other legislation out in throughout the United States being approved. That's just like Oregon's hub legislation, and the states, six of them, have been trying to pull the hubs out of Oregon. They have elected to stay here because of the good business environment of Oregon. They have a collaboratory relationship with the commission.
Meaning we're willing to take the 700,000 hits so that we don't lose more if they take the hubs out.
Exactly, Mr. Chair. Yes.
How many jobs or people go, Mr. Chair?
Please.
How many jobs or people go with those hubs, or is it just a bank of phones someplace?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it's several hundred jobs, actually. There is a hub location in Portland, which employs a large number of workers, and there's seasonal workers as well during the bigger, like the Kentucky Derby and so forth. So it's a significant number of jobs. I don't have an exact number.
Okay. But you've answered my question.
Yeah, please continue.
Thank you. Oh, so, in essence, in essence, this performance measure shows that the original intent of supplementing the summer fares purses from the development fund basically has been met, and now with the changes in the industry, you know, the hub revenue has been given out to other sources as well, such as Portland Meadows through the Oregon HBPA.
HBPA.
Which is the Horseman's Benevolent Protection Association. All these acronyms. I apologize.
And why is giving money to Portland Meadows for the Benevolent Association a good thing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, live racing has been struggling for such a long time, and the purses or the prizes in Oregon are about the lowest in the country. And in order to keep, it costs about $600-$700 a month to train and care for a horse, and some of the purses for the races are like $1,500 or $2,500, a very low amount. And in order to keep, because of the business losses that have occurred out at Portland Meadows, the HBPA, which also contributes money as well to this purse account fund, the commission elected to also take a chunk of this money that they had available and give to the HBPA to ensure that the purses were at a high enough level.
One more question.
You know, of us here, I want you to questions at will.
My curiosity is, in a lot of the discussions that we've had in this session since we arrived in January are about racing, dog racing, horse racing, Portland Meadows, now the Racing Commission, and all the dialogue has left me with the impression this is a dying industry, and I don't know whether or not that's true. I've attended a couple of horse races. They're exciting. I understand there are a lot of people that work at Portland Meadows. But I hear folks speculating about other uses for Portland Meadows, and I hear about purse supplementation and all. And I'm just curious, what's the long-term prognostication from your professional vantage point about this industry?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, you're absolutely right in that it has been for a long time a dying industry. The closure of Multnomah Greyhound Park is an example. Huge old venue, minimal amounts of racing, large overhead, it's closed. Greyhound racing, I think, could do fine in a smaller venue. In the long term, if Senate Bill 929 completes its passage through the House, and it provides that simulcasting can be done year-round without live racing occurring for 12 months out of the year, it'll be more like 6 months out of the year Portland Meadows will run, then there'll be 6 months of just simulcasting. The simulcasting revenue, which is the sending out of the signal and receiving signals from tracks around not only the country, but the world, one of the things that I think is going to boost the simulcasting revenue and the tax that we have on it is the change this winter with the federal, the 30% tax on money coming into the United States from outside. Without that tax, that's provided an incentive for a lot of tracks outside the country to possibly start wagering in on United States tracks, and that I think will be a real huge benefit. We're already seeing a little bit of that now in contracts that have to be in place for all of this to happen with a track and another track outside of the country. What's going to happen with year-round simulcasting, hopefully, is that the purses will increase. There is a contract that I know that the track has a contract with the horsemen, and in that it provides for a growth of the purse account. With that, there's a very good breeding program in Oregon. I think that's going to continue to grow.
One of my constituents is Breeder of the Year in Oregon, so I'm very familiar with the quality of the breeding going on in this state.
Oh, that's excellent. And I think with the increase over with the purse supplements, it's not going to happen next year, but I think if they can continue going over the next year, two, three, they're going to see an increase in those purses. And another thing, and that will draw folks in and increase breeding. I've been speaking with a number of people in Southern Oregon who are interested in starting more promotion of racing. Horse racing actually provides for $510 million worth of business and jobs in Oregon. So it's still a pretty big thing, but it is, they're living hand to mouth. Yeah.
I can't think of a more exciting 2 minutes than the Kentucky Derby, or however long that is. Two plus minutes, I mean.
Did you win?
No.
And that basically concludes the performance measures. Do you have any additional questions?
I don't think so.
Thank you.
To proceed. Or is that it? That, Christina, do you have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Christina Shearer, Department of Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management Analyst. Before you is the now ubiquitous and hopefully your last presentation on the governor's recommended budget. The Oregon Racing Commission is actually in the administration program area. So this is a chart you probably haven't seen before, but it is the pie chart that shows total funds for the program area of a little over $7 billion. And you'll notice racing is 0.1% of that total. And on the general fund and lottery funds side, obviously, the racing doesn't appear at all because they have no general or lottery funds. They are, in fact, a revenue generator, as Paul's already pointed out. The Racing Commission falls under the economic development principle in the governor's budget. Moving on to page 4, the total budget expenditures for 05-07 are $5.3 million total funds. That is all other funds, as we've already discussed. And the sources of those revenues include pari-mutuel receipts, license fees, and charges for services. As Paul's pointed out, there were several significant changes that occurred after the governor's recommended budget was put together, so we will be proposing technical adjustments to this $5.3 million level to bring it back in line with more recent revenue forecasts. There is only one program unit in this agency. It is a very small agency, so you see it all under operations. By budget category, the agency breaks down personal services at $2.3 million, services and supplies at $1.1 million, and the special payments are those hub revenues that are going out to the various entities that receive it, and so that's those, that portion of the budget is 35%. Moving on, I'm going to briefly touch on this chart on page 7, but as we've already discussed, those numbers are already going to change, so I won't go into too much detail. Suffice it to say that prior to the closure of the Greyhound track and the discussion regarding hub revenue, we expected the revenue to increase, and therefore this increase of 13.3% was largely in the special payments area where you would see that proportionally increase when revenue increases. Moving on to page 8, under policy issues, again, the Multnomah Greyhound Park closure is an issue that necessitates revenue and expenditure changes. And the agency has already taken steps to reduce expenditures in line with the closure of the track, and including the layoff of staff and the holding open of positions. As we've discussed, there is increasing competition for the multi-jurisdictional simulcast and interactive wagering totalizer hub, forevermore referred to as hub revenue by other states. I take it to heart when you say you really want to hear the whole thing first before you get the acronym, and I said it once, and hopefully that's enough.
Oh, I don't know. We'll see.
There are rules to follow, you know.
Obviously, under fear revenue issues, the revenue issues arising from these policy issues are obviously we're no longer receiving the revenues from live Greyhound racing in Oregon. And the live handle and simulcast handle from horse racing here in the state has been relatively flat. It goes up and down according to the economy, but you're not seeing any big swings, and we're not anticipating a lot of big swings at this point in time. And again, uncertainty regarding the hub revenue. The handle is increasing and has been, but the tax rates and competitive issues may reduce this revenue, either by our own design or by having us lose hubs and their handle. As a result, we are proposing a number of technical adjustments related to the closure of the Greyhound Park and related to an updated revenue forecast based on the new whatever action the board is planning or the commission will take on May 19th. I will also point out that the agency has a couple of policy packages. One of them is routine in nature, and it's increase in special payments related to hub revenue. And again, when we modify the revenue forecast and expenditures related to that, we will have to modify that package to bring it back in line with what we expect to distribute. And there is also a policy package to reclass two positions in the agency. It's a very small staff, and there are a couple of positions that have needed reclass for some time. And it's a package for two position reclasses totaling $22,000. And that is all I have at this time.
How engaged is your board in that? I noticed from the materials you meet monthly. How engaged are they in reviewing your performance measures, in talking about your fiscal situation? Would you characterize this as an activist board, a policy board, or advisory?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, they are a policy board for sure. They also are a regulatory board in the fact that they impose discipline on our licensees, and they also are very involved with the fiscal operation of the agency. In meeting monthly, they really are hands on.
Who are your commissioners now?
The commissioners now are the chairman is Stephen Walters. He has been with the commission for 13 years. Mr. Jeff Gilmore, Lisa. I forgot Lisa's last name.
This wasn't a test. I just think in the presentation materials, it's always nice for us to see the geographic sweep of your commissioners, and it's just nice to know who their names are.
Sure.
If we see them. You could also pass on that because of Mr. Gilmore's dereliction of duty and his failure to show up today to testify on behalf of this budget, I'll probably be a no.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, he's been at everything. I don't know why he's not here today.
It was only his testimony last time that swayed my vote, and in his absence, clearly, total disregard for his fiduciary relationship with the board. I'm afraid I might have trouble.
Well, I think you could fairly tell him that half the committee present was against the budget. I mean, that might
more fear through his spine.
All right. Did I answer your question?
Thank you.
Ms. Scherer, anything else?
No, those are all the comments I have prepared for you, unless you have any questions for me.
No. Director Hansen? Anything?
Well, Mr. Chair, can I just go forward with my outline?
Yeah, just proceed.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. You have a handout that kind of gives an overview of the Oregon Racing Commission. Also on the back attached is a document called the Portland Meadows 2004-2005 race meet, and that's just a number of statistics that are kept daily that we use within the agency to look at, and it helps with our regulatory in our regulatory capacity. Some of them I'm sure will be Greek to you, but believe me, it does help. Also, you have a Portland Meadows 2004 report. Mr. Bob Blair, our presiding steward, who has such a wealth of historical knowledge, has put together this document with a little help from me, and it goes through and has years of history in it as well, so it's a very interesting document.
I'm just looking at the back of this where it says med violations. Lasix? Oh, a diuretic. Thank you. I was just trying to think
it was eye surgery on horses.
Yeah. Thank you. I answered my own question.
The Oregon Racing Commission exists to regulate all aspects of the paramutual industry in the state of Oregon for the benefit of the citizenry, the licensees, the participants, and the state of Oregon, and that is the mission of the Oregon Racing Commission. Basically, in other words, we exist to protect the public, all of our licensees, which we have 7,000 of, and the state through fair, consistent regulatory practices. The ORC was established in 1933. Chapter 462 provides the statutory authority for our broad authority over paramutual wagering. The ORS and the administrative rules under 462 cover general provisions such as licensing, prohibited conduct, paramutual wagering, such as specific rules which govern live horse racing and greyhound racing, the simulcasting and multi-jurisdictional simulcasting and interactive wagering totalizator hubs. The Oregon Racing Commission has developed some goals, which are under review, to accompany the legislatively approved performance measures. And one is to ensure that races are run safely. That falls under the number of horses, starters, that have to be put down per 1,000. But it also, we have a medical director who's a veterinarian and another state veterinarian who are present at the races. We test a number of horses. It's really amazing that drugs and performance enhancements are used on these animals, but they are. So we test for those to make sure that Lasix and Bute are the only two drugs in those horses. And in Lasix, that the diuretic is used to help prevent bleeding in the lungs of the horse. They lose water and then that, but somehow that means that they're not going to bleed in their lungs. Also, Bute is kind of like aspirin for animals. And also, goal number two is to ensure that races are run fairly. We have our the stewards who operate out at the tracks. We have our licensing to make sure that everybody's licensed. We have our investigators who do an excellent job, not only patrolling and looking for things in the barns, such as needles and so forth, but they also make sure that everybody's licensed. They investigate complaints. They find violations. The third goal currently is to provide a regulatory framework which allows simulcasting to enhance live racing at the commercial tracks. And they are the off-track sites or off-track wagering parlors, which they're statutorily are allowed 20 of, are located throughout the state, and simulcasting occurs out at these locations, and that helps to boost the live handle. Goal number four is to provide a regulatory framework to allow the licensing of these hubs and to keep them here in Oregon. So, in essence, the ORC, which has been around for a long time, is fairly established, performing pretty well, and we're accomplishing our mission on many levels. We have a positive rapport with our licensees and the industry that we regulate. I was hired as the executive director on March 1st, 2003, so during the last budget presentation I was brand new, so at least I know what the definitions are this time. One of the things that the commission asked me to do was review the agency as a whole and to...
Before you summarize that for us?
Yes.
I just wanted to let you know that for the members that are here today, we're looking favorably upon what you've given us. And if you wanted to just give us a very quick summary to gavel out and let you get on your way.
Well, Mr. Chair, I really appreciate that. So I'll give you a quick synopsis. Senator Johnson, is that okay?
That's great.
Great. Okay, so we've done a lot of things at the Oregon Racing Commission. We've completely restructured our staff. We have a great staff now. I guess you can, and we followed the appropriate procedures with our AAG. So we have a good team now. They're doing their job, and that's excellent. We have a number of activities that we do that have already been touched on as far as the licensing and overview of the live racing and everything that has to do with it. Frankly, I'm really excited about this upcoming year biennium with the changes that we have and to see what we can do to enhance live racing, both horse and greyhound racing, and that's it.
That was Director Hansen. Thank you. Siebert, do you have anything further?
Mr. Chairman, that's it. And I would also note that the scheduled meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee of Transportation and Economic Development.
For the record, just let me mention, too, that we did have time set aside for public testimony here today. There's nobody present in the room. We've had a good presentation by the director. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5026 and adjourn. Thank you.
Thank you.